Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're watching and listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, our special guest is Gary Wayne. Gary is returning to us. It's been a few years since we've talked, and Gary has a lot of information to share. And I felt it would be a good time to bring Gary back because all the stuff going on here in the surface world, it really does have a tie-in to Gary's work. If you remember his books, The Genesis 6 Conspiracy, How Secret Societies and the Descendants of Giants Plan to Enslave Humankind, and he's recently come out with part two of that, How Understanding Prehistory and Giants Helped Define End Time Prophecy. So without any further ado, Gary Wayne, welcome back to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
Well, thank you for inviting me back and so happy to be with you and looking forward to talking to your audience again and sort of maybe getting more update as to where we are on things and anything else that your audience would like to talk about.
Well, yeah, what we see now on the surface, Gary, is this seemingly jockeying for position, jockeying for power amongst these different rulers of these different regions of the world. And you've
Yeah.
talked at great length about the bloodlines and how the leaders of these various factions here on Earth, they seem to be descended from these Nephilim, this pantheon of gods that you've spoken of. Can you give us, from your perspective, how that's playing out today? Because there is an upsurge of UFO, even cryptid activity worldwide. Phenomena is going through the roof. And once again, as in the days of yore, we're having all this conflict, strife, and chaos on the surface, which seems to be a calling card for this pantheon of gods. So, whatever direction you want to take it, Gary.
Yeah, so I mean, whether it's the pantheon of the gods or the celestial mafia godfathers, as I like to call them, and their spuriously created offspring, their MO is perpetual war and to try and destroy the planet and humankind from the face of the earth so that we don't have an opportunity to reach our destiny. And with a promise extended to their purest offspring that out of the ashes, like the phoenix rising out of the ashes in the Masonic allegory, or Shiva as a destroyer god that destroys the earth before renewing it again, that's the world being promised to their offspring. So they had an opportunity to try and apply all of the technology that we're just catching up to today back before the flood. And there was an intercession done there, and the flood came versus the destruction by fire, which is promised for the age of Aquarius in polytheism, and as introduced by Lord Maitreya in that sort of allegory of an Antichrist type figure. And just as it's reserved for fire is reserved for the destruction in the end time in 2 Peter 3. So you have this aligning of the end time, different outcomes, but talking about the same kind of events, just as you have the same kind of events talked about in prehistory. So the celestial mafia godfathers, as I like to call them, from the Council of the Gods, that's talked about in polytheism, whether it's at Mount Hermon, Mount Saphon, Ur, Olympus, all around the world, appointed the divine right to rule to their ring lords as they were understood in the Antediluvian epoch, which were the giants, their spurious offspring. And then again at the assembly of the Tanu, probably the same assembly, just different giants after the flood, like at Mount Saphon and Mount Hermon. So this is a war that's been going on all throughout our history between the invisible ones, the pantheon of the gods, their offspring, and the destruction of humankind. And now we see events that are sort of coming back into play that are reassembling the ancient scenario. And whether or not it's in polytheism or it's in monotheism, you have this understanding that nothing is new under the sun. What was will be again. And that comes out of Ecclesiastes in chapter one. And the understanding of this only brings sorrow and grief in the Bible. And it's the same virtual saying just seen through the polytheist lens in polytheist religions. And so it's going to be a very messy time. So these dynastic bloodlines have been ruling the earth both before the flood, then again after the flood. So dynasties, their bloodlines, the royals being kings of God, as you take that back to its ancient Indo-Aryan and Hebrew meanings, means roy as in king, goes back to regal and regis in Latin, from Indo-Aryan reg to rule. And so these are the same royals that we would understand as kings. And A-L, E-L, I-L are all transliterations in the Middle East, and other ones very, very similar for an angel or a god. So like Baal would end in A-L, and Royal ends in A-L. Baal means Lord God or Master God, depending on how you want to translate that. And so these are the kings of God. They've received the divine right to rule, just as King Charles, who was just crowned in his recent rite of inheritance, which is an ancient ritual that goes back to this oath-based loyalty sworn originally at Mount Hermon with Haram Anathema, Hebrew word Haram for cursed or accursed, and anathema, an ecclesiastical term to carry it out to the end, no matter the consequences, to create the giants to destroy humankind from the face of the earth. So this ancient rite that King Charles did goes back to swearing an oath, not to the God of the Bible, but to a specific fallen angel or God, as we would call them, celestial mafia godfather, and specific Nephilim and Raphaim patriarchs. And that's all embedded into their coats of arms, and they keep their genealogy. So Prince Charles, when he was prince, said he was a descendant of Vlad the Impaler. And Vlad the Impaler is this classic Scythian noble Celt with red hair, hazel eyes, pale skin, blood drinker like Nephilim and Raphaim were, takes his bloodlines back to a tribe founded by Hercules, the Egrithi, a Scythian tribe. There's also another scioning in that bloodline, going back to an angel named Tamiel, or Kezidiah is named in the Book of Enoch, that will ennoble that bloodline. So two ennobled bloodlines in the Vlad the Impaler bloodline. And Hercules is the son of Zeus and Alcmene, and part of the Cretazens of the spurious offspring. So they keep their genealogies, as is the example and the point I'm making, back to these parent godfathers and patriarchs. And however pure or ennobled those bloodlines are, an ennobling by grafting in or scioning in other bloodlines is where they fit in the overall hierarchy. So roll this forward not to the present time, but to World War I. You have a war that breaks out between the Romanovs, which is the Putyanin bloodline out of Kiev, Scythians, and they are a junior offshoot of the Putyanin Ruhr-Kurd dynasty. You have the Kaisers and the Habsburgs, which is the sort of Middle Europa and Germanic bloodlines, and also intermarried into the Hungarian and Romanian bloodlines of the Anjou and the and Vlad's bloodline, which is how you get that interconnection and genealogies going up to the Hanovers of England to Windsor, which the Windsors changed their name in World War I from Hanover to Windsor. There's probably another, German name in there as well, as there's intermarriage with Victoria at that time with some other royals of Cook's Saxburg, if I recall correctly. And so you have also the bloodline of the Windsors that are in power, and you've got a king of Spain, which is a bloodline of the Bourbon bloodline, that is going to intermarry and be part of the Habsburg scioning bloodline. And currently you have King Philippe of Spain, who is the king of Jerusalem title of the Anjou, that he as that they get from their genealogical basis of their rights to that title through the Anjou that goes back to the Anjou that were crowned as the kings of Jerusalem after the taking of Jerusalem in 1099 by Godfrey de Bouillon, who's also Anjou of the Lorraine region. And the Payon is Anjou of the Lorraine region. And then you have an Anjou of the Lorraine region that's directly related to the Hungarian Anjou and is also directly related to the Savoy Anjou. And all three groups will make claims to that Jerusalem title, but King Bourbon had Philippe Bourbon inherited that title from Juan Carlos from the von Habsburg bloodline, and that came across to the Habsburgs through the Habsburg Lorraine dynasty, and that King of Jerusalem title going from the original kings to Hungary with the Anjou to Lorraine back to there and then over to the Habsburgs. They keep these genealogies. It's important to understand that. So when we look at other bloodlines around the world, we need to be aware that there's more than the 13 Western families, because this is a commonality right around the world. So you would have the Inca Roca and the Roca family out of the Inca bloodlines, and you have Mayan bloodline. I won't go through all the different bloodlines. I'll do a couple major ones that are important for the geopolitical makeup today, other than obviously the European families. But you have dragon creator gods in China that created the Xia dynasty both before and after the flood. XIA is the spelling of Xia. That's the complete dynastic lineage, the Western and the Eastern branch of all the Chinese dynasties down until World War II, until social masonry was set as a virus on to China, just as it went into Russia, just as it was established to make the Nazis and the Kaisers fell because of that. It's a Western bloodline ideology that was created to bring down rivals because they're a perpetual war. There can only be one family that's going to eventually rule the world. They're all vying for that, just like the Highlander movies. So Xi, even though he's part of the Communist Party, that's name is equivalent to Xia, XIA, but denotes it more from the Western bloodline. And now he's declared himself president for life, probably going to reestablish the Xia dynasty through himself, and will probably never give up that dynastic power. And he's on an empire-building mission. You have Putin, who says he is received his name through the Putyanin bloodline, and how he gets there, according to his own mythos, is that, and what he had published in Russian newspapers in the early 2000s, is that his grandfather comes out of nowhere in the 1850s. Some versions is great grandfather, and that happens through the Putyanin royal family of Kiev. The original Scythian czars, the ones who started Moscow in about 1000 AD with Vladimir the Great, who Putin holds in very high regard and has a statue up of him. And then it passes on through intermarriage to the Romanovs, which is a junior offshoot of the Anjou. So when he talks about, like with Tucker Carlson, he wants to rebuild the Romanov dynasty, he believes that he's an offspring through his grandfather, who was an illegitimate child of one of the royal Putyanins. And in that tradition, you would receive some money so that you wouldn't be in poverty, part of the name, but not in the inner circle. And his father moves to St. Petersburg just before World War I, which is how Putin ends up in Russia. So what he's doing is trying to reestablish his original Scythian, Tartarian, Putyanin dynasty. And that's why he looks at Kiev as a holy city and wants that as part of his empire, and he doesn't want to destroy it. So we're going to see this jockeying for power can continue because it's just the start. And so the United Nations has the world, and FEMA has the world. When they divide things up, and the Club of Rome, they're all a little bit different. But they have the world divided into 10 groups of nations. And this is important because they call this the beckoning of the New Age and the Age of Lord Maitreya, according to Alice Bailey, starting in 2025. I don't think Antichrist is going to be coming to full power in 2025, but understand how things are converging. And that They call this new age that Lord Maitreya, or the Messiah type figure, no matter which religion that you're going to talk about. It's either the false millennium that Antichrist will promise in Christianity, the Mahdi millennium of the two Mahdis of the Shia and the Sunni of Islam, Hitler as an Antichrist figure with the Third Reich, 1,000 years reign. It's all the same sort of reign that's being talked about, that's being promised, which is understood as the new golden age that they're promising. And the golden age was the age of Atlantis before the flood, with the 10 demigod kings, offspring of Poseidon and Climene, who were trying to impose their world religion and world government over the whole world. The 10 kings of the Lord of the Rings, so to speak, or the assembly of the Dattanu, or assembly at Nippur, whatever you want to call that. That is what they were doing as the council. That's the visible ones that were reporting to the invisible ones with the council of the gods. And so in prophecy, from a Christian perspective, we get in Daniel 2, Daniel 7, Daniel 8, Revelation 12, 13, and 17, 10 kings, 10 toes, 10 horns, same allegory for this end time empire that's going to rise up as the last beast empire, that Antichrist will rise amongst at the midpoint to start the eighth beast empire. And so this is the jockeying of position that we're starting to see, is how do these 10 empires rise? And they rise in the age of the sorrows, or the birth pangs, as in the oration of Jesus in Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 17, and 21. And this includes wars and rumors of wars, pestilence, famines, and earthquakes as contrived catastrophes to cattle herd people into, through the chaos that it's going to cover, world government. And so you have different visions of this new world order that I like to call the Nephilim world order, or the Nephilim from the invisible ones' perspective, the fallen ones. If you take that back to Hebrew, the Europeans have their own vision. And so they use the US as their attack dog to bring about their vision of a European dominated 13 families and world government. Well, Xi and Putin, for example, have said, we're not against a new world order. We're against you guys dominating it. And so I think that's what we're starting to see. We're starting to see through the BRIC nations. I don't think all of them stay in there, but certainly India will. And, the tri-axis is going to be, India, China, and Russia. But those are three of the five toes in Daniel 2 of the 10 toes of the statue, the giant statue. They can't have more obvious imagery for the bloodlines than a statue of giant beast kings, and the end time of these 10 kings, and that they're going to be positioned against another five kings. So they're going to be kind of united, but not totally united, and it's going to cause a whole bunch of war getting there and afterwards. So Daniel 2 calls an empire made of iron and clay versus iron, which was the Roman Empire, versus bronze, which was the Greece Empire, versus silver, which was the Medo-Persian Empire, versus gold head, which was the Babylonian. So you'd see a degradation of the purity of those bloodlines as they come down, and clay is typically understood as human. So there's going to be a significant human combination in there, whether individual kings or just diluted bloodlines of these genealogically driven and based royales. So they're not going to get along. It's not going to be as strong, because they're going to be warring even once things get going. So when we want to have a look at what's going on in the geopolitical scenario today, we need to understand the history, and we need to understand the royal bloodlines to see what is driving these seemingly wars that aren't required. If everybody wanted to live in peace, things would be fine.
And for the benefit of our listeners, could you explain the difference and the connections between what you refer to as the celestial mafia gods and the gods or the Nephilim on Earth, and also the difference between the Nephilim and the Naphilim, because I know you make a distinction between the two.
So when we look at the word hero as it's understood in Sumeria or in Greek history and other places around the world, it's understood as the offspring of a god or a goddess and of a human male or female to produce a semi-divine individual. And this would be a Nephilim, as we would understand it, or a Raphaim, or it would be like Gilgamesh, who's two-thirds god and one-third human, as he's described in the Epic of Gilgamesh, as is Enkidu. So when I talked about Zeus having a wife or a consort named Alcmene to produce Hercules after the flood, that is a demigod. It's a hero. It's a titan of the earth versus a titan of heaven. So the root word for the original giants biblically is Nephil, and I am for the male plural is Nephilim, where in the KJV would translate that as a giant. Now, the root word for Nephilim is Naphal. So slightly different spelling, Naphal. Original Hebrew and Semitic is NPL for both. And it derives Nephilim, not only in terms of as an offspring, but it carries some of the meaning in a relationship, but doesn't carry the full meaning. Naphal is the word fall or to fall or fell in Hebrew. So when you see in Isaiah 14 where where Satan fell from heaven, or was felled from heaven, or whatever the grammatical version of your translation that you're reading is, that's the Hebrew word Naphal. And I am is the plural, and the male plural can also mean one. So when you see, say, Nephilim, that would be in the plural understanding as the giant ones. When you hear seraphim as fallen angels, that would be serpent ones. Gibberim would be mighty ones. And so Naphilim would be fallen ones. The fallen ones are the ones who followed Satan, who first fell from heaven in Isaiah 14. And the fallen ones are of the Shemayim, the heavenly ones. So they're the fallen ones of the heavenly ones, and we understand them as fallen angels in Christianity and Judaism and Islam and in polytheism. They would understand that as the gods.
When one goes back and studies these secret societies and mystical orders, and especially as it ties in with these expanding empires in the prior to and during the age of colonization, there seems to be like this mystical supernatural element. For example, Dr. John Dee, Astrologer Royal of Queen Elizabeth I, working with Edward Kelly, they conjure up some angel who begins talking to them about the British Empire. And pretty soon they start making these trading corporations that go all over the world, waving the British flag. And then you fast forward to Alice Bailey, the Lucis Trust. And what was interesting is those guides, those spirit guides, those ascended masters, once again, talk about, of all things, global domination. You look at what we have today, this open embracing of Luciferianism by Hollywood, by even academia. I see that as a direct tie-in to what had gone on in the past, pushing this globalist agenda.
Yeah, it's the recreation of Atlantis is what they're trying to do. Because nothing is new under the sun. What was will be again. And they've been trying to recreate this with the beast empires all the way through. So this angel is either a fallen angel or it's a demonic spirit. And we don't know whether or not they were communicating with one or the other or both. But it's interesting because John Dee becomes the mentor for Francis Bacon, who becomes the most powerful. And of course, John Dee is 007, as he has the same, is the source name for the 007 Bond movies. And so Bacon is the second most powerful individual in England under Queen Elizabeth, and then under Prince James, the first Prince James Stuart. And Francis Bacon creates a new English language to be the Babel language of the world as they're envisioning it. So through the Spear Shaker Society and the Knights of the Helmet Society, which is a typical MO of the polytheists, to have these writing guilds, like the Inklings would be a modern version, to keep the history and the genealogies alive in literature. Again, a common MO that still goes on to this day. They were creating a language that would be the language of the world and the language of business as they foresaw it. Along comes Prince James, the mighty Prince James, as the King James has him named, which is Gabor for a mighty one, and a royale with the divine right to rule from the council of the gods. And all the kings believed in the divine right to rule. And that he buys into this commonwealth and continues to fund the commonwealth expansion that Bacon and Dee and the Knights Templar and others have envisioned to create this new Babylon for the end time. And so King James is also the one who sponsors the KJV Bible, which makes this new Baconian language currency around the world with that expansion through the Bible. And then through that expansion, the secret societies are going to use Masonic lodges as their base point to continue to spread their power and control. So the Illuminati would work out of them, Rosicrucian initially, and that's all part of the extended sort of organization. What's interesting about the KJV Bible is they changed the word Hebrew rem from wild bull to unicorn. And really, it all always translated that way when it's related to Mount Hermon and the empire of Ephraim in the end time and associated with Manasseh as an end time prophecy. And so he's putting a marker. And probably Bacon is the one who edits it back in that he is that unicorn king or a descendant of the unicorn king or an antichrist wannabe, because in the end time, the antichrist is the single horn that grows up amongst the ten in Daniel 7 and Daniel 8. And I cover that off, those connections in detail in book two. And that the coat of arms of the Hanovers had two unicorns. And the English crown and the Stuart crown had a lion and a unicorn, just as you see the same carryover of lion and unicorn for the Windsor coat of arms. The creatures that are on the coat of arms are taciturn communication of their original celestial mafia godfather patriarch. And all the other symbols in there are, again, heraldry was created by the royals in ancient times so they could put it on a flag. And when they rode into another realm, the royals there would instantly understand who they were and what bloodlines they come from. And it's still used to that same day thing today. And I won't go through because it's a long explanation, but the unicorn is two allegories. One is it was the original horse of the giants for going into war, both before and after the flood. And it's a chimera type of being. It's not just a horse. And it's a DNA manipulated type of horse. It's also an angelic being. So it's depicted in Greek mythology as the unicorn in its original versions as white single-horned horses pulling the chariot of the gods of Apollo and Zeus and the goddesses as well. And cherubim are depicted in the Book of Psalms in Ezekiel 1, 3, and 10 of pulling in the vision of God's chariot. There's an Ophanim watcher in the wheels, meaning wheel angel, the wheel ones, and which is Ophan in Hebrew. And we see that name come up in the book of Enoch as a group of watchers, the throne angels, as we might understand the standard sort of Christian analogy of who these angels are. and that the cherubim have four faces, and they're also watchers. So they have a face of an eagle, face of a bull, a face of a human, and a face of a lion. So in this case, you have a cherubim unicorn, which is sort of masked as one of the bloodlines in that Sion bloodline, and then you have the lion face of a cherubim who would have produced Nephilim, who looked just like them. So when we read of in the Bible, the lion men of Moab after the flood, or the lion-like men of Gad or Arioch, a king of the Mesopotamian giant kings in Genesis 14, which Arioch means lion-like, and you have the Urmahalu and other names for these Nephilim warriors both before and after the flood. Nergal would be a god that the Avim giants worshipped in the Mesopotamian region. The Avim were also in the covenant land, and Nergal is a lion-faced god. So it's like a cherubim taking one face in a physical form, and then reproducing giants that look just like them. So that's the taciturn language of the gods that form up their ennobled bloodlines. So it's important to understand that this unicorn was, I got sort of on a rabbit trail there to explain what I was talking about, but that unicorn is to reflect his desire to be an antichrist at that time, because they're always trying to bring this about through a world empire. Doesn't quite happen, but that mythos and that bloodline continues with the Windsors today as a possible rival antichrist. I'm not saying the Windsor families are going to be produce the Antichrist. We don't know who the exact ones are. And we know there's always three European ones ready to go all the time. And there will be other Antichrist figures around the world. So it's interesting when you make that sort of connection. And all of that lines up perfectly with what polytheism says they want for the New Age.
What are the hallmarks or harbingers, if you will, which will bring about the Antichrist? And taking into account what you just said, that there may be more than one presumptive Antichrist, is the Bible explicit in describing events that have to transpire before we see the advent of one or more of the Antichrist?
Yeah, there is a chronology, and we can't get lost into things getting worse as we go through the birth pangs, as those birth pangs get stronger. I mean, until we get to 25% destruction of the world and population, that's the seal openings, which is starting about at the time of the last 7 years. So we're not there yet. We're probably in the fig tree generation, as Jesus describes it. And there's a specific generation. We don't know how long that generation is. It could be 40 years, as generation is described biblically in the wilderness in the time of the Exodus. It could be 7 years, as the Psalms describes it, or it could be 120 years, as described in Genesis 6:3, when God limited the physical nature of giants and humans to 120 years, because he didn't want immortal physical giants in the world. It was a violation against the laws of creation and against the Holy Spirit. But the fig tree allegory is important to understand, because the fig tree represents the southern kingdom of Judah that King David first ruled over and then amalgamated the northern tribes shortly thereafter. And so Israel is the northern kingdom and is the vine. And so when we're talking about the vine and Ephraim, that's the prophecies that King James was looking to overlay his bloodline onto, and the commonwealth of the nations that were prophesied in those end time prophecies. And so, but it's the southern kingdom that produces the Messiah. And the southern kingdom was the last of the two nations to receive its final curse of the covenant and the diaspora after rejecting their Messiah. So when Jesus, just before he goes into the temple to predict Jerusalem's overthrow and temple destruction, and thereafter gives his oration of the set chronological order of events in Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 17, and 21, He goes up and eats from a fig tree. After eating the fruit, he kills the fig tree because it's no longer bearing fruit. And so then he goes into the apocalyptic prophecies for the curses of the covenant for rejecting him as the Messiah. And so he says in the fig tree generation that when you see that fig tree in bloom again and in season, no, this is the generation that he is talking about, and everything that he has just predicted will take place. So Israel was put in the land in 1947 with a declaration of war in 1948. A lot of people think that that's the start date. I think you have to have Jerusalem as being occupied by Israel at that point in time before you can start that countdown, because clearly Jerusalem is part of all end time prophecy. It's like the epicenter, so they have to be in control of that. So that would start it in 1967. But then again, we don't know when, how long that generation is. If it's 7 years, we're going to get into the last 7 years in the 2030s. If it's 120 years, we have a ways to go. So we don't want to get ahead of chronology. So we have to go through the birth pangs first, and they're going to get worse. And that's the jockeying for position of this global empire. And with the catastrophes getting worse, there's a rise of false prophets that are going to produce contrived prophecies of catastrophes that they're going to create, saying, if you do not convert to the one true religion, we'll be destroyed from the face of the earth. And so they're going to say, convert before it's too late. And so they're going to introduce the Age of Babylon. And I used that term just a few minutes ago, that that was the Templar dream. Babylon in the Templar dream was to utilize and then reignited through the Jesuits, noting we have a Jesuit pope today, to create the Babylon within the Roman Church to take to the rest of the world. Whether or not that's the way the universal religion comes or not, that's just one of the plans to sort of bring it about. And that Babylon is this universal religion, and it is a geopolitical organization, and it is a commercial organization, and it is a city. We have to understand it in those four parts as it's described in the book of Revelation and other parts of the Bible. It's said to be a city nine times in the book of Revelation. So there is a specific city where the woman of Babylon, who rides the beast empires, holding the reins as she did in all the beast empires, both before and after the flood, with the Nephilim bloodline kings before the flood, Raphaim and other bloodlines after the flood. It is the daughters of Babel religion, Babel at Nimrod, Nimrod's Babel is the root for that. As you see, Babylon in Revelation goes back to the Hebrew word Babel, and the Enochian antediluvian mystical religion he restarted at Babel, and the religions that came up through the beast empires around the world are the daughters of Babylon. This is the mother of all of those pantheons around the world. This is the original religion that controls the beast empires both before and after the flood, will be there in place today. It is the glue that is required to bring about the beast empire. So she has to rise first through the false prophets. So until we start to see that happen, and you're going to need a universal religion to create the last 7 years. How do we know that? Because Daniel 9:27 says Antichrist, who has not taken power yet, who doesn't take power to the midpoint of the last 7 years, is the one who's going to negotiate the covenant of death in Daniel 9:27, which is for 7 years. And in the middle is the abomination, where he's crowned the king of Jerusalem, as the king of Jerusalem, Anjou, envisioned their bloodline receiving that crown and their right of inheritance from dating with Godfrey de Bouillon, who was the first ruler of Jerusalem with the Templars in 1099 when they took Jerusalem. That's that bloodline of the kingdom of heaven and the movie associated with it, that they belong to, and how they'll make their claims. So we have to see Babylon rise first, and we're a ways away from that. And the only way you're going to create a universal religion is through these horrible catastrophes and prophecies of the false prophets who bring about these disasters and then present the solution. Now, if you look at Daniel 9:27, in the first 3.5 years, Israel is going to be permitted to do their sacrifices on a wing or an extension or an overspreading of the temple, as the wording is understood and translated as it goes back to the original Hebrew. Well, you can't do that with the mosque today with split religions. So you're going to have to destroy Christianity and fold it in. You're going to have to fold and reinvent monotheist Judaism and fold it in. You got to do the same thing with Islam, and that's generally done through the Sufis, which is polytheism within Islam. It's done through Kabbalism, Sabianism, Essenicism, and all sorts of mystical groups within Judaism. And the Gnostic Christians who have molded into Christianity will be all working to help bring those religions down and back into what they would call the mother religion that they say went rogue in the time of King David and the monarchy to create a monotheist religion and a mythos for the monarchy, because they believe Moses brought back the religion of Egypt with them, where he was educated and initiated into. So that's the story they're going to weave. It's from a Christian perspective, don't believe it, but they're going to make a very good case, and they're going to have to de-deify Jesus to do that. So lots to do.
We're already seeing that this latest outburst by Kamala Harris, when someone yelled out "Jesus Christ is Lord" in the audience. I think that's what they said, and she said, quite plainly, "You're at the wrong rally. Go somewhere else," implying that whatever force they represent is directly counter to the force and the principles espoused by Jesus. And what's interesting too, when you were talking about that, didn't Donald Trump, when he was president, openly state quite controversially that Jerusalem, he regarded Jerusalem as a world center, and that he would like to have an embassy and a consulate there and recognize it?
Well, he did recognize it, and they are building their embassy there. I had expected Biden to overturn that, but they didn't. So I would expect that that's going to continue. And so when you see somebody like Kamala Harris say a Christian isn't welcome, and then yesterday, I think she said in an interview, "I pray to God every day," she's not praying to the God of the Bible.
Yes, absolutely. And
They use those double entendres all the time in plain sight.
well, not too long ago, there was one of those Mystery Babylon Super Bowl halftime extravaganzas, and one of the acts featured a woman riding a beast, right? In a way, reproducing what you've just been talking about. And what we've seen with this latest iteration of this inversion of divine feminine principle, we see the advent of the AOCs, of the Kamala Harrises, of the Hillary Clintons, this kind of distorted, perverted version of Lilith. Now, how does that play out? Because you mentioned also we're going to start seeing more Marian visions, we're going to start seeing more visions and dreams of Hathor, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it probably goes back before Medjugorje in Yugoslavia, but your thoughts on that and how it ties in to this deranged kind of feminine principle we're seeing now.
So it's the Queen of Heaven that's coming back. And the Queen of Heaven was as powerful or more powerful than the King of Heaven. And so in polytheism, all the gods had a patriarchal god and an equal or more important female god. So that's coming back in the Babylon religion. And that these are, as we call them, queens of heaven. And queens of heaven are talked about in the Bible, in the book of Jeremiah, where they're doing sacrifices to the Queen of Heaven. Just so that we know that the Bible generally gives us a reference to what is being talked about. And then it gives us a complete description of the Queen of Heaven, that is the one who runs the polytheist religion. And that's why you have a lot of the prophets that are prophetesses in a lot of the, it's an important part. So when you look at, for example, the Sibylline prophecies, and I cover these ones off in book two, is that they had a original Sibylline and prophet presence at Palatine Hill with the Etruscans, which were the proto-Romans. And so Romulus and Remus, who are the offspring of Ares, demigod giants, start the city. They're going to move in there, and there's going to be seven hills that's going to be part of the old city of Rome. Palatine Hill is the capital hill. Vaticanus Hill was outside the original city. It's inside the city walls now, but that was an Etruscan hill as well, and it was a branch temple of the Sibylline prophecies located at Palatine Hill. And so it's probably going to be interconnected as a branch to the original Sibylline prophecies that would have been in Rome. Rome has seven hills. Babylon sits on the seven hills. And Rome is a city. So likely the city, you can make an argument that Constantinople has seven hills, and it was originally part of the Roman Empire and a very powerful city, and has a break-off religion from Roman Christianity, but it wasn't recognized as the seat of Satan in the time of John, like Rome was, and it wasn't called Babylon as an allegory, like in the book of Peter, as it is as what Rome is. So, but I don't want to get into too much minutia, but look at this religion as being filled with prophets, because that's the Sibylline prophecies. Anywhere where you see this Queen of Heaven understanding, that's going to be associated with that same sort of understanding of the polytheist religion, Babylon, and the false prophets. So Isis is a allegory in Freemasonry as an offspring Queen of Heaven after the flood, consort to Osiris, also an offspring god, for the original consort of probably Satan, which isn't named. And so, because all the gods had a consort, and it could be what's talked about in the allegory of the Leviathan aspect of the female Leviathan that was killed in prehistory, and the second Leviathan is dealt with in the book of Isaiah in the end time. So this could be that mother goddess at the original point, which was the original Queen of Heaven ruling with Satan. And then in the lower pantheons, you have a duplication with that same organizational structure. And so we get antediluvian queens of heaven like Inanna in the Sumerian pantheon, right? That's a queen of heaven. Ashtaroth is a queen of heaven before the flood. Gaia is a queen of heaven before the flood. Sophia, it would be an allegory for the original mother goddess, Gnosticism, that creates the 12 archons that the Gnostics believe also included the creation of the God of the Bible as part of those 12 archons through this nebulous male force of the universe, is how that sort of comes about. And Sophia is the word for wisdom. So Sophia is the root word for philosophy, which is the love of Sophia, which is the theological guidance for the seven sciences that created mysticism originally. And Sophia is what they're saying, naming a lot of this AI technology out there, in honor of Sophia. Sophia is, when it says wisdom in the New Testament, it goes back to the Greek word Sophia. And so they're going to use that along with the Hebrew version of wisdom, like in the book of Proverbs, which is, a word, I'm trying to remember what it is. I think it's Shema and Shamak, and the AH is the female plural that's used there for wisdom. And they're saying that that is denoting in both cases that the Holy Spirit is a female. Well, typically, when you have the AH suffix, it can mean a female, but usually it's the application of the word. It's like an action verb being applied there. So it would be the application of wisdom. And who's being talked about in the book of wisdom there is Jesus. So it's not, but anyways, they're going to confuse the two and bring it home with Sophia as being called wisdom and the Holy Spirit, because the Holy Spirit is known as wisdom in Christianity, bringing the wisdom, right? So they're going to use that as part of the way to bring Babylon into overlay onto branches of monotheism and bring them back in. And so Mary and Mary Magdalene are understood by polytheists as the Queen of Heaven or the Mother of God. And so that allegory will continue. And so, yes, the Mary apparitions are going to be part of this, and they're going to be in different gods like Hathor and other goddesses in other pantheons around the world, which seemingly is becoming more and more common. And they're going to try and bring the world back to this original Babylon religion that was of old.
In the time we got left, in Revelation, it speaks about the dragon and the Antichrist, and you talk a lot about the serpent dragon bloodlines. How does that all tie in? Well, what relationship, if any, will the Antichrist have with the dragon, and who or what does the dragon represent within the context of Revelation?
So within polytheism, they talk about the dragon Messiah. And it's in all religions, and including like the Musus and Musus in Sumerian and Egyptian royal bloodlines as their dragon Messiah. And so they envision, just as Lord Maitreya is a Indo-Aryan word for that comes out of Hinduism. It's an Indo-Aryan word that means Mithra and Mithra's covenant. And Mithra comes, and Lord Maitreya comes as this Antichrist-like spirit, or the Christ consciousness, as an avatara into an avatar, just as Vishnu was the avatar for Buddha. So that's why Lord Maitreya is the new Buddha. And so you have all of those connections, and you say, well, okay, now how does that get back to the bloodlines? Okay, I understand this Antichrist figure could be a Nephilim-related character, but understand the bloodlines are from the fallen angels. There's one specific watcher that is a dragon or a serpent, and dragons and serpents were understood as the same. That's a seraphim, and known as the seraphim ones. They're six-winged serpent-faced angels. These are the dragon creator gods, because they're dragon angels. So whether it's the Nagas, whether or not it's Quetzalcoatl, Viracocha, Osiris as an Uraeus type of a flying serpent god. These are seraphim angels that were creating bloodlines. And so expect that Antichrist is going to be part of the dragon bloodline. And they tend to track that through the fairy allegory of the bloodlines that starts new dynasties. So you have these fairy kings and these fairy queens. So, like King Arthur, son of Uther Pendragon, the patriarchal bloodline, was married to Guinevere, which is a fairy queen of the matriarchal bloodline. And their allegory is that they are male and female goddesses, and he's a sun god and she's a moon god, or and other titles that go with it. And that they're representing the new Atlantis, right, with the Excalibur of the Scythian sword and things like that. So when we have the fairy allegory, I understand that you use a pureblood fairy female because they were so rare to start new dynasties. And that carries on the genes that produce the Rh negative blood and the gens that they talk about, whether it's the LB gens, whether it's the Cretazans, whether it's the Julia gens, the Fabia gens, and all the different genses of the royals around the world, they track that. And so you have an intermarriage of Eliphaz and Timna in Genesis 36. with the dukes of Edom. Eliphaz is the son of Esau, brother of Jacob, who lost his Messianic blessing, lost his inheritance, and the other blessings associated that Jacob stole from him, and then had his name changed to Israel. Timnah is a Horim female, son or daughter of Seir, a Horim founder of the Horim in the Seir region where Mount Seir is named after. And it goes back to the Hebrew Satyr. Okay, well, maybe even taking it back to a goat god as a patriarch, but certainly he's hairy like a goat god anyways. And so you have this new dynasty of this pure bloodline as a rival to Israel and the Messianic bloodline that produces Jesus, and this hybrid matriarchal Timnah that is put in, and they're going to wipe Israel from the face of the earth if given the choice. And they try to. They're the first ones to attack Israel coming out in the Exodus to inherit by law what Esau had lost. And Esau also married Oholibamah, which was also a Horim. So created another dynasty of giants, which in that whole area that would be hybrid giants, which are a little bit smaller than the pureblood Rephaim giants after the flood. Why is that important? Because they're called the Dukes of Seir. Duke is the Hebrew word Aleph, and Alephim, as the Catholic Encyclopedia talks about this bloodline of kings, that is the source word and part of the double entendre allegory used for fairy kings and queens. That's going to intermarry with the Mitanni dynasty and other dragon and fairy queens in Sumeria and are part of the Tuatha Dé Danann. Can't go through all of the genealogies right now, but just understand that they are the fairy folk and from fair skin and part of that fairy allegory of giants. And Uther Pendragon comes out of the Tuatha Dé Danann bloodline. But it's this Aleph, which is transliterated into elf, and the elven Magianic bloodline of the Gnostics and the Tuatha Dé Danann, which is the dragon messiah from the patriarchal understanding. And so they're wanting to put their dragon messiah, their dragon bloodline, that would go back at least in part to a seraphim watcher angel and a specific patriarch of Rephaim or Nephilim. And one deduces that to deceive the Jewish people, they're going to have to graft in bloodlines. So in the Anjou bloodline, they graft in King Saul's bloodline. They graft in David's bloodline. And then allegedly and falsely, I think, they put in Mary Magdalene and Jesus's bloodline into their bloodline that is inherited through Dagobert, the last of the Merovingians that goes into the Anjou startup. And so they have these genealogies that go right back to these divine rights to rule and to the council of the gods and to specific patriarchs. And so when we look at that Christ consciousness and the bloodline and the pedigree, look for both to be part of the Antichrist mythos and understand in 2 Thessalonians 2, Antichrist receives his power from Satan and all the power that he can provide him. And that Satan, in the time of Judas, who's called the son of perdition, just as Antichrist is called the son of perdition, which is the word that's associated with Apollyon, as you take that back to Greek, and the one who comes up out of the abyss, just as Antichrist is described as the one who comes up out of the abyss. So there's a connection, what comes out of the abyss also to the Antichrist figure. With Satan, we see when he sees that Judas needs more wisdom, power, and strength and courage to continue to betray Jesus, to become the son of perdition as part of the understanding of Antichrist, he enters into him to give him that power. And then we then see in the end time that Antichrist will have Satan's power, which means he's going to be an avatara of the avatar. He's going to be a Christ consciousness. that's going to come first. And Antichrist can mean opposite of Christ. It can remain replacement Christ, or it can mean before Christ. So just as the original Antichrist figures, like antediluvian ones or Nebuchadnezzar or Alexander, they could be considered Antichrist in the before, and also replacement and also polytheist, so therefore sort of evil Christ, that will fit all of those sort of definitions, and that he will receive great wisdom just as Vishnu gave the wisdom to Buddha to start Buddhism.
Well, that's quite a tour de force I just provided to our listeners and viewers here in the first segment. Thank you so much, Gary. How could our the viewers and listeners find your work, and could you talk a bit about the two books?
Yeah, so I want to just so that you know that when we talk about bloodlines, to let people understand that we are told of bloodlines in the Bible. So from a Christian perspective, I won't go through all of them, but the two that you really want to read is Psalms 21, 8 through 10. And then also with the terrible ones, you have to read book two to find out more about what the terrible ones are, but it means Aretim, and they're in the sides of the pit of the prison, as Ezekiel 32 talks about. But Isaiah 25 says that this branch of the terrible ones are going to be destroyed in the end time, and that in Psalm 21, there's going to be this bloodline, as we'd understand it, that their fruit is going to be destroyed from the earth and their seed from among the children of men. And that this is an ongoing thing that's going to be resolved in the end time. So the best place to get a hold of me is through my website, the Genesis6conspiracy.com, Genesis 6, the number 6 conspiracy. And I have both books with generous excerpts of all 98 chapters of book one and all 84 chapters of book two on that website for people to get a good view on. And book one is a little easier to read if you're not really familiar with the Bible, and it gives more of an understanding of how the Bible intersects with secular history and polytheist history, and talks about these bloodlines and the beginning of polytheism, what happened before the flood, what happens after the flood, and the conspiracy to bring about the end time through these bloodlines and present the dragon Messiah. So book two is a book I said I wouldn't write because I didn't want to be redundant, but book two is specifically targeted at Christians, and it shows how the World Testimony intersects with the Bible, but in ways that are completely different than it's in book one. And for Christians who want to know what happened in prehistory and understand the Old Testament, this will give you that whole understanding. And if, you know, people have told me book one brings the Old Testament to life, but for Christians, this will really do it for you. It'll show you how it connects into end time prophecy to understand the allegories of Babylon, or what a dragon is, and all the other allegories that go along with it. And so it has also a chronology that I put down for end time prophecy, and I show you my approach. And I know there's a lot of different approaches out there, and which is why I lay out what my approach is, and you can test how I apply my approach. I do it with the same, whether it's research in prehistory or prophecy. And what I would encourage people to do if you're interested in prophecy is you're going to have to become learned yourself. But if somebody is coming at you with a preconceived conclusion and trying to mold everything around that preconceived conclusion, they're going to have to leave out inconvenient passages or reinvent what passages say. Those are two red flags. And I would say put everything around what Jesus said, not vice versa. And don't reinvent what Jesus said. So my approach has a lot of rules, like 10 major points that I utilize to keep it on the path, and there cannot be any conflicts. And once you put prophecy around what Jesus said and use Jesus's chronology and template that can also be used for Revelation, because it's a testimony of Jesus Christ given to the angel to show John. So it can't be in conflict with his template in Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 17, and 21. All the conflicts go away. and the chronology just pops out at you. So maybe some more things we can talk about in book two. So if you want to get a signed copy from me, go to the buy now page, book one or book two. I live in Canada, so I ship out of Canada. There's a Canadian page for Canadians if you live in Canada. There's a page for the US, and there's an international page for if you live anywhere else in the world, and I send books all around the world. You can link over to Amazon.com, Amazon.ca, and BarnesandNoble.com. Also, you can link over from the website to the Kindle version of both book one and book two. I don't have a connection up there for the Audible version for book one, but it's on Amazon Audible now. Just came out about 6 or 8 weeks ago and is doing quite well. And book two will be out before Christmas. And it's also available through iTunes as well for the Audible.
Thank you so much, Gary. And we're just getting started. To our dear listeners and viewers out there, if you like what we do, if you believe what we do, please go to thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up and become a member, and we'll see you at the top of the next segment.